Welcome to Sassy Reads for You with Annette Botko, a.k.a. Dolly's Daughter. Sassy takes you surfing through books and her own perspective on reality. A production of Cosmic Reality Radio.
Welcome to Sassy Reads for You. This is Annette. I'm also called Sassy. We are reading Cosmic Reality by Nancy L. Hopkins. We're reading book one of this Cosmic Reality book, which has two books in it, The John Kennedy Jesus Christ Connection. We started this last week and made it into part of chapter two, and we are at the section called Dallas Doctors. And we're just going to jump right in. Dallas Doctors. John Kennedy was alive, although not breathing, when brought to Parkland Medical Center, minutes away from Dealey Plaza and the Texas Book Depository. In attempting to resuscitate the president, attending physicians did a procedure called tracheotomy, which clears a passageway to the lungs by making a small hole in the throat area. As the president's tie and shirt were removed, doctors found a small bullet hole in his throat, perfectly positioned as an incision point for the tracheotomy. Five Dallas attending physicians believed the bullet, which had pierced the throat, was lodged somewhere in the lungs, because Kennedy's respiratory system continued to be erratic even after the successful tracheotomy. While the throat wound was not fatal, the head shot was lethal. President Kennedy died before Dallas doctors could ascertain for certain the path the throat-wounding bullet had taken. The path of the bullet hitting Kennedy in the head did not appear to be a mystery to the Dallas doctors during the nationally televised news conference later that afternoon. I clearly remember Dr. Malcolm Perry pointing to his own right temple, demonstrating the point of entrance. This most important event was carried on the three major networks, yet Lifton could not locate any piece of film concerning that press conference. So although still photos existed with Perry pointing to his right temple, the film record had apparently disappeared from the libraries of the three networks. Dallas doctors believed a bullet entering the front right temple traveled through Kennedy's brain, exiting at the point where the skull had been blown open in the lower right rear area. The soft brain tissue failed to stop the dum-dum bullet, which blew open a telltale exit wound in the right rear skull. The bullet entering the neck was believed to have traveled downward, affecting the respiratory system. It would appear the conspiracy to frame Oswald as the sole killer had failed, if Lifton's crazy theory was correct. The tracheotomy incision would have to be surgically enlarged to look like an exit wound, but to reverse the picture presented by the president's broken skull would, if possible, require a massive amount of surgery. Certainly such surgery would be apparent to an autopsy physician. Bethesda autopsy. In fact, the official autopsy doctor, James Humes, testified to the Warren Commission that Kennedy's brain had been surgically autopsied before the official one began. Humes had related this information in such technical data, no one understood what he was really saying. Humes graphically and technically related what he had seen before beginning the autopsy. Unfortunately, there were no neurosurgeons on the Warren Commission, nor was there one among the critics of the commission's verdict. It was not until an interested David Lifton requested a neurosurgeon friend to provide a layman's explanation of what Humes had said that the truth became known. There's lots of pictures in this book, folks. And I think Nancy's going to try and put it on the website or in the chat as we play this. So you might want to look, because it shows what the trajectory of the bullets were supposed to be on President Kennedy's head. Dallas doctors describe Kennedy's head wound as in the lower right rear of the skull, egg-shaped, about 2 inches by 2 3/4 inches in size. What Humes found at Bethesda, where the autopsy was conducted, was a massive head wound, 5 1/8 inch across, extending from the lower right rear upward for 6 inches between Dallas and Bethesda. The wound described by several doctors in both locations had been expanded by twice its size. Moreover, at Bethesda, the wound was completely devoid of scalp and some 70% of the right brain was missing. Observations Dallas doctors had somehow failed to perceive. Furthermore, when Humes removed the blood-saturated head wrapping not applied to the president's head in Dallas, skull fragments had fallen onto the Bethesda autopsy table. And what of the throat wound? Instead of a cleanly cut incision extending the small bullet hole for 1.5 inches, Humes found a widely gaping wound with irregular edges about 3 inches long. Regardless of apparently sloppy technique, Humes realized a tracheotomy had been conducted, and he did not immediately interpret the wound as a bullet hole. Humes did not know about the bullet wound until the following morning, when he spoke by telephone to Dr. Perry in Dallas. Humes changed the official results of the autopsy to include the conclusion that the tracheotomy had been made at a point where the bullet had exited the throat. The official version was not released until November 24, 2 days after the autopsy. In this way, Humes was able to explain away the strange, apparently shallow puncture wound found in Kennedy's back during the autopsy reported by the two FBI agents. In the official autopsy results, Humes raised the wound. Now it corresponds to an entrance wound for a bullet supposedly exiting into the front throat area, later used as the point of the tracheotomy. What the hell did I just read? Let's try that again. Okay. Humes challenged the official results of the autopsy to include the conclusion the tracheotomy had been made at a point where a bullet had exited the throat. And originally it was said that they did that where it entered the throat. Right under Dallas doctors. It says, doctors found a small bullet hole in his throat, perfectly positioned as an incision point for the tracheotomy. Five Dallas attending physicians believed the bullet, which had pierced the throat, was lodged somewhere in the lungs because Kennedy's respiratory system continued to be erratic even after the successful tracheotomy. Okay. So that was the entrance wound that they thought it was. Okay, so the Dallas doctors thought it was the entrance wound, and now Humes is saying that it was the bullet exited through the throat. The official version was not released until November 24th, 2 days after the autopsy. In this way, Humes was able to explain away the strange, apparently shallow puncture wound found in Kennedy's back during the autopsy reported by the two FBI agents. In the official autopsy results, Humes raised the wound. Now it corresponded to an entrance wound for the bullet supposedly exiting in the front throat area, later used as the point of the tracheotomy. Okay. Yet Dallas doctors believed the neck wound was an entrance point for a bullet that became lodged in the upper respiratory system. Humes contributes a concerning the Dallas observation by noting the right lung was bruised near the top. Humes ordered photographs taken of this area. Shots which were not included in the official set of autopsy photographs. Two caskets. But when and where could all of this have taken place? At Parkland Hospital, the body was wrapped in a sheet and placed in a bronze casket, put aboard Air Force One, and flown to Washington. It was taken off Air Force One and transferred by a hearse to Bethesda for the autopsy. The only possible way for the body to have been surgically altered in the allotted time frame would be for the bronze casket to have been empty. Well, they could have done it on Air Force One. Just saying. Lifton located Bethesda witnesses who saw the president's remains in a body bag as he lay in a plain gray shipping casket. Somewhere en route, the body had been removed from the bronze coffin, brought to a facility capable of taking x-rays, and surgically altered. In a crazy episode reminiscent of a Keystone Cops routine, the president's body was returned to the bronze coffin and brought into the autopsy room in time to be officially autopsied by Humes. Lifton's evidence was impressive and well presented. In his best evidence, I think that's the title of a book he did or something. But I would still have a hard time swallowing this far-fetched scenario had it not been for the one little piece of my history. I remember being 15 years old and watching televised views of Bethesda during the time the president's body was arriving. At one point, the film crew actually showed the second coffin being taken off an ambulance and brought into the rear of the building where the autopsy was to take place. I remember the commentators wondering aloud as to what it all meant. Was it just luck that had the television turned to the network with the camera in position to see the second coffin? Granted, David Lifton was able to answer innumerable questions voiced by myself and others. And he certainly provides a vast treasure of documented evidence to support his claims. But it was my memory of the second casket that forced me to accept Lifton's strange theory as the most probable manner in which the president was executed and how that execution was made to look like the work of one crazy person named Oswald. Lee Harvey Oswald. Who was Lee Harvey Oswald? That question led me to look in David Lifton's bibliography of best evidence for more information on this alleged crazy killer. The most interesting listing was a book entitled Legend, The Secret World of Lee Harvey Oswald, written by Edward J. Epstein. The book was out of print, and my bookstore clerk said it would take months to locate an available copy. I decided the expense and time were not worth getting a book I was not positive would be of value. Perhaps I would have gone to a library in hopes of finding the Epstein book, but more likely I would have just forgotten the whole thing. As it was, I left the bookstore and continued on to my next stop, a large discount store. As I was making my way through the store, I came upon a section of discounted books. On a whim, I searched and found a $1.98 copy of Epstein's Critical Data on Oswald, the Marine. In October 1956, Oswald entered the Marine Corps, finishing seventh in his basic training class. In August 1957, he set out for Atsugu Air Force Base. Sorry if I totally butchered that name. 35 miles east of Tokyo, Japan. Atsugu was also the location for the Joint Technical Advisory Group, containing one of the CIA's main operational bases in Asia, as well as the home base of the ultra-secret spy plane, the U-2. The Defector. In November 1958, Oswald redeployed to the United States, where he was honorably discharged from the Marines. In September 1959, Oswald defected to the Soviet Union. In response to the defection, Oswald's discharge was downgraded to dishonorable in September 1960. Secretary of the Navy at the time was John Connally, later with Kennedy in the Dallas motorcade as governor of Texas. Oswald stayed in the Soviet Union for 2.5 years until June 1962, when he returned to the United States with his Soviet wife, Marina, and their daughter A year and a half later, Oswald was killed in Dallas while in police custody for the killing of President Kennedy and wounding of Texas Governor Connally. KGB connection. There are facts which could lead to one to believe Oswald was an assassin working for the KGB. He had, after all, defected to the Soviet Union. In addition, in October 1963, a month before the assassination, Oswald allegedly went to Mexico and the Soviet embassy, where he talked with a member of the KGB. In fact, evidence of Soviet involvement in the assassination was compelling enough that on June 24, 1964, Richard Helms, manager of a covert CIA activities, met with Chief Justice Warren to inform him of the possible KGB connection. It is probable the Warren Commission may have believed in the KGB link. It is important we do not underestimate the amount of planning that went into the assassination. In covert operations, a good plan is to create two or more deceptions. The backup deceptions are there in case the primary cover story is blown. In the assassination, the primary cover story is that Oswald was a crazy, disaffected individual working alone to kill the President of the United States. If someone dug deeply enough and broke through the lie concerning Oswald's sanity, a second protective lie had to exist. In the Kennedy killing, the planners needed Oswald specifically as the patsy to effectively create the second assassination cover story, namely that Oswald was working for the Soviets. By making Warren Commission members believe Oswald was a KGB agent, any piece of data not fitting the Oswald crazy man scenario could be overlooked by individuals believing they were working in the best interest of the nation. In those dark days following the assassination, with the fear associated with the Cuban Missile Crisis a year before not forgotten, some of those covering up important data concerning Kennedy's death may have firmly believed they were protecting the American people from being informed of a Soviet involvement in the assassination. In protecting Americans from the truth, some may have believed they were protecting the world from a nuclear crisis. New Orleans. Another set of evidence has been interpreted in two ways. The evidence is derived from Oswald's activities upon his return to the United States, beginning in April 1963 when he went to New Orleans. During that time, Oswald has been linked to the Mafia, as well as both pro-Cuban and anti-Cuban activities. This leads to the possibility the Mafia planned and executed the assassination due to their perceived need to stop John and Attorney General Robert Kennedy from further pursuits against organized crime. Or, one could argue, Fidel Castro was out to get the president because of a CIA plot to assassinate the Cuban leader. Good Lord. A number of books have been written supporting both these interpretations. However, All such theories are based upon the assumption that disaffected Oswald, while he did not act alone, was part of the assassination team. While I think he may have been part of the team, I believe he was working undercover as a U.S. intelligence operative. This just gets deeper and deeper, doesn't it? Okay, the agent. For a number of years, I was a personal security officer for the United States military. That position provided knowledge concerning requirements for obtaining and keeping a security clearance, which gave me a unique perspective on Lee Oswald. I came to believe Oswald was working as an American spy when he defected to the Soviet Union. If Oswald was still working for the American intelligence community when he returned to the U.S., his activities in New Orleans takes on an entirely different interpretation. Perhaps he was spying on the Cuban and mafia organizations rather than a mentally disturbed participant. Oswald's unit in Japan was Marine Air Control Squadron 1, codenamed Coffee Mill, which assisted in tracking America's super-secret spy plane, the U-2, as a member of this unit. Oswald must have held at least a security clearance, probably a top-secret clearance. While assigned to Coffee Mill, Oswald did certain things which should have been grounds for immediate revocation of his clearance, and therefore his access to secret U-2 information. October 27, 1957, Oswald grazed his own upper arm with a Derringer's .22 caliber bullet and was charged with having an unregistered weapon. Confinement and was suspended. June 1958, Oswald was convicted in a summary court-martial for using, quote, provoking words, unquote, and sentenced to 28 days in the stockade. October 1958. Oswald went for medical treatment after an apparent nervous breakdown, which should have resulted in revoking his clearance, but did not. This failure of authorities to take any security precautions concerning the erratic, irresponsible, and certainly not trustworthy Oswald is baffling. This apparent breakdown in normal security practice was particularly glaring in light of the September 1958 compromise of the U-2 radar system. This situation would have been considered a major security breach involving Oswald's unit and should have been brought all unit members under intense scrutiny. Such an investigation would have uncovered Oswald's irregular attendance at a local bar where hostesses were believed possible communist agents. The soldier's monthly $85 could not have supported the $60 to $100 cost of a date, never mind frequent visits. Yeah, I'd say. In light of the rest of Oswald's background, I began thinking it is likely he was acting as an American informant in some capacity. With this working theory of Oswald being an American agent, I began looking for other evidence that could paint Oswald as a spy, or when he went to the Soviet Union, as a double-double agent. After all, Oswald's favorite television program was the story of an FBI double-double agent. I lived three times. Double-double agent. How do you get that? So if you're a double-double agent, a double agent would be a U.S. agent who pretends to be a Soviet agent to the Soviets, right? I'm not going there. Okay, where was I? In October 1959, a month after arriving in the Soviet Union, Oswald met the senior consular officer in Moscow, Richard E. Snyder. Oswald wanted to renounce his U.S. citizenship. Snyder later testified Oswald made remarks concerning valuable information he intended relating to the Soviet authorities. On May 1, 1960, Francis Gary Powers had his U-2 shot down by by a missile that probably homed in on the spy plane's radar. Oswald had access to information which could have assisted the Soviets in downing Powers. The U-2 incident and Oswald's stated intention to Snyder to provide the Soviets information naturally leads one to believe Oswald could have been guilty of releasing secret information on the U-2 project. Such action would have put him in a position of being indicted under U.S. Espionage Acts. Even if innocent, Oswald would have come under suspicion by competent American authorities. In the face of it, Oswald should have feared the consequences of returning to America, where he should have been brought up on espionage charges, whether guilty or innocent. Yet Oswald did return to America and was never even questioned about the U-2 incident and his possible compromise of classified data. This all seemed confusing until one piece of data was brought to light. As of May 1959, the CIA had been informed by the most valuable undercover American spy in the USSR, the US-2 program had already been compromised. Any information Oswald could have provided the Soviets was already dated by the time his defection 6 months later. Thus, before his defection, Oswald was an ideal candidate for playing double-double agent. He could endear himself to the Soviets by releasing classified information the U.S. knew had been compromised while posing no real security hazard. Consul Snyder in Moscow had continued contacts with Oswald. One episode in particular made Snyder believe there was some unofficial official communication between Oswald outside the State Department channels. So not only do we have double-double agents, we have Snyder believed there was some unofficial official communications. So we have double-double agents and unofficial official communications. Okay, just had to point that out. Lee's mother, Marguerite, obtained an appointment with two State Department officials in Washington concerning her missing son. This resulted in a query letter being sent to Moscow by diplomatic pouch on February 1, 1961. While Snyder had still not responded to the query on February 13th, a letter from Oswald arrived postmarked the 5th. The only explanation Snyder could offer regarding how Oswald knew about Marguerite Oswald's concerns was to assume he was communicating with someone outside official State Department channels. If Oswald was still a loyal American in spite of his Soviet defection, that channel would be someone working for the U.S. intelligence services. Marguerite herself later suggested on the night of November 22, 1963, during an FBI interrogation of her, that her son was a government agent. The probability Oswald could be arrested on espionage charges regarding the U-2 incident did not dissuade him from requesting a return to the United States. Oswald also made the request his Soviet family accompany him. On May 31, 1962, as Oswald prepared to leave the Soviet Union, FBI headquarters ordered Oswald to be interrogated upon his return. The FBI had an open file on Oswald since his defection. An initial questioning of Oswald's associates had been conducted 5 months after his defection, a month before the U-2 was shot down. There exists an FBI memorandum supposedly sent to the State Department indicating an imposter could assume Oswald's identity. It is unclear why this message was sent. The lookout card that was supposed to have been placed in Oswald's State Department file in response to the memorandum was never found. Another reported FBI action taken regarding Oswald was on November 10, 1959. when a flash notice was placed on Oswald's FBI fingerprint card to preclude an imposter. Upon his U.S. return, Oswald was interrogated by FBI agent John W. Fain. Fain suggested the ex-defector be re-interviewed and took it upon himself to re-question Oswald on August 16, 1962. 4 days later, the Oswald case was closed, although it is not known whether a fingerprint check confirmed Oswald's identity. Dropping the case is perhaps not extraordinarily suspicious, except in considering the FBI's decision not to question Oswald's Soviet wife, as part of its ongoing program of interrogating Russian emigres. Even more suspicious, due to Marina's uncle being a ranking member of the Soviet military intelligence service. Seriously? Okay. Dropping the Oswald case, in light of the U-2 incident, his defection, supposed fear of an imposter, along with the FBI failure to question Oswald's wife, borders on criminal neglect, unless the FBI knew Oswald worked for another intelligence agency. Even the CIA acted strangely upon Oswald's return by failing to follow through on procedure for interviewing returning expatriates. Yet, while the CIA would have been interested in Oswald's remarks concerning anything the Soviets had done, the FBI was the agency that should have shown most concern. Oswald or his wife could be working as a KGB agent, and Oswald may have broken his security oath by passing classified information to the Soviets. These areas would have been under the jurisdiction of the FBI. Evidence indicates the CIA and FBI were either very incompetent regarding Oswald, or they knew he was an agent for some other U.S. intelligence agency. If it was incompetence, it stretched throughout the intelligence community. After 4 months in Fort Worth, Texas, Oswald became employed at Jagers, Shiles, Stovall, a firm working on classified military maps. The ex-defector, who could have already broken his security oath, was once again given access to American secrets. The Soviets considered map work so important, every map produced in the Soviet Union was classified, and any release for public use had built-in errors. From the Soviet point of view, Oswald's return to the U.S., particularly with a Soviet wife, would have presented a bad image. Perhaps the Soviets just wanted to be rid of the Oswald problem and did not consider image. On the other hand, suppose Oswald convinced the Soviets he could return to the U.S. and be a friend to the Soviets in some role. At the map firm, Oswald could have been a Soviet agent passing on vital secrets, or he could have been working as a double-double agent passing information with U.S. built-in errors. In any case, Oswald was in a sensitive position. If he was an agent for either country, only some mission of greater importance would have taken him away from Jagers, Chiles, Stovall. Epstein could not determine why Oswald was fired from the firm in April 1963. It was then Oswald went to New Orleans and became involved with Cuban and mafia activities. The increasingly agitated activities of Cubans and growing anger of the mafia against Robert Kennedy's attorney general activities were a threat to the administration, if not the president himself. As New Orleans was a central hotspot, it would have been advantageous to get a government agent into New Orleans to spy on the Cubans and the mafia. Lee Oswald had grown up in New Orleans, his uncle had mafia connections, and Lee was a supposed communist sympathizer. If he was an agent for the U.S., Oswald had uniquely unique credentials for infiltrating the ongoings in New Orleans. Which agency? Who was Lee Harvey Oswald? I believe evidence indicates he was an agent for the United States government. Just as it took a neurosurgeon to uncover the autopsy surgeon Dr. Humes had really said was to the warrant. Let me try that again. I'm sorry. Which agency? Who was Lee Harvey Oswald? I believe evidence indicates he was an agent for the United States government. Just as it took a neurosurgeon to uncover what autopsy surgeon Dr. Humes had really said to the Warren Commission, it took a personal security officer to see something was very suspicious concerning Oswald's continuing access to classified information. But what agency? The United States intelligence community is comprised of both a military and a civil branch. The civilian branch is further divided into the Central Intelligence Agency, CIA, responsible for foreign espionage and counter-espionage, and the Federal Bureau of Investigation, FBI, looking at domestic intelligence and counterintelligence. The military branch is overseen by a control group at the Department of Defense level, with each service, Army, Air Force, and Navy, operating independent intelligence operations. Oswald, as a Marine, was in the Navy, which operated the Office of Naval Intelligence, or ONI. While serving as a Marine, the most critical data Oswald had access to was on the U-2, and that project had been under the security jurisdiction of the Air Force and not the Navy. However, the Air Base where Oswald was stationed was also the location for CIA activities. If Oswald was an American agent, the ONI is front contender. Epstein's book on Oswald connects various documents relating to Oswald to the ONI. For instance, Oswald's October 1959 Moscow meeting with Consul Snyder to renounce his U.S. citizenship was reported in a State Department telex with copies forwarded to the CIA, FBI, and ONI. Interestingly, the commander of naval operations in Washington was additionally notified in a separate cable sent by the Moscow naval attaché. Another strange connection to the ONI was made after Oswald's return from Mexico, a month before the assassination. Oswald made a trip to Mexico, where he allegedly went to the Cuban and Soviet embassies, supposedly in hopes of returning to the USSR after a visit to Cuba. The CIA's Mexico agents were watching the Soviet embassy, and on October 10th informed the FBI, ONI, and the State Departments about Oswald's activities. While there was no request made for further investigation into the matter, something continued to bother the CIA field agents. On October 23rd, the CIA Mexico office requested a photograph of Oswald from the ONI. The ONI failed to respond. After the assassination, a photograph appeared, supposedly taken outside the Soviet embassy in Mexico by the CIA and purported to be Oswald, although it clearly was not. The CIA was to later claim that photograph was not theirs and no picture had been taken during that time frame. For although photographic records were standard procedure, for some unexplained reason, the day Oswald was allegedly at the Soviet embassy, no pictures were taken. Or perhaps there were no pictures to take because Oswald was not there. And remember the lookout card that was supposed to have been placed in Oswald's State Department file? In response to the FBI memorandum concerning a possible Oswald imposter? While the lookout card and the memorandum were not located in State Department records, the ONI Oswald files did have a copy, of the memorandum. The possibility the Office of Naval Intelligence had a certain Lee Oswald in its employment is very interesting. If one accepts David Lifton's belief that Kennedy's body, the best evidence as to what had really happened in Dallas, had been tampered with before the autopsy. The assassination's planners would have attempted to gain absolute control over the official autopsy report. Not only were the attending doctors absolutely ignorant about forensic pathology, all the doctors were naval officers. None of those officers reported any perceived problems with the autopsy. Granted, the doctors were there because of their positions at Bethesda. In addition to Admiral George Berkeley, the President's doctor, in attendance was the Surgeon General of the Navy, commanding officers of the Naval Medical Center at Bethesda, and Bethesda Naval Hospital, and the Navy Medical School. It must have been a really full room. The Secret Service connection. None of the problems with the autopsy would have existed if Texas law had been carried out. The Dallas medical examiner did not autopsy the body as stipulated by law. As the medical examiner attempted to claim Kennedy's body, Secret Service agents at the scene emphatically refused to release the remains. This action appears a bit odd and quite unauthorized. Did the Secret Service agents take this great responsibility upon themselves because they were afraid someone would try to further harm an already dead president? This final controlling effort on the part of the Secret Service is suspicious in light of the whole plan. To have succeeded in the complex scenario envisioned by the planners of the assassination, they would have had to possess detailed information concerning the Dallas trip well in advance, depending upon the number of wounds incurred by occupants of the automobile, plant the correct number of bullets linkable to the Carcano rifle, control the limousine eliminating adverse physical evidence, set up the sniper's nest tied to Oswald and facilitate its findings, and gain control over Kennedy's body. David Lifton identified one group having opportunity to accomplish all these varied tasks, the very group tasked with protecting the president, the U.S. Secret Service. It was the Secret Service agents who planned the details of the Dallas trip, including the motorcade route. Control of the limousine was in their hands. It was the Secret Service agents who discovered the two bullet fragments in the car after the autopsy had been conducted some 9 hours after the assassination. Lifton also makes a case the limousine's windshield may have been switched to eliminate evidence of a bullet having come through the windshield. Even the one intact, virtually perfect, infamous one bullet, and in parentheses it says bullet 399, was discovered on a stretcher at Parkland Memorial Hospital in the immediate vicinity of a Secret Service agent. And moments before Lee Oswald was shot to death while in police custody by Jack Ruby, Oswald had a conversation with Secret Service Inspector Thomas J. Kelly, who went on to brief the Warren Commission on x-rays taken of the president's body at the autopsy. If Lifton is correct in his assessment of the evidence, indicating there was a great deal wrong with the autopsy, interpretation of the x-rays was a critical element. Lifton wondered why a Secret Service agent was used to brief this data instead of some objective, qualified expert. When all is said and done, if you believe there was a conspiracy to kill Kennedy and frame Oswald, you have to accept members of the Secret Service, Navy, and Dallas Sheriff's Department as being implicated. The resulting cover-up further implicates the CIA and FBI. What common element could unite such apparently divergent agencies and men in such a horrific event? What could bring two or three or more dozens of men to willingly participate in the assassination of the President of the United States? This may be the crucial problem for conspiracy buffs. The amount of planning and control over all aspects of the assassination implicates too many people. How could these people keep the secrets for over 40 years? The very concepts of this vast conspiracy stretches the imagination. And there was one more piece of the puzzle that was very perplexing and bothersome. The Nazi connection. Good Lord. Okay. If we assume Oswald was not an insane killer acting alone, we must also assume he was manipulated into playing Patsy. Someone had to be the manipulator. In espionage parlay, we are looking for a handler. We are looking for someone who placed Oswald at the right place at the right time. The Texas School Book Depository on November 22, 1963 at 12:30 p.m. Ruth Payne informed Oswald of a job opening at the Texas Depository, and her neighbor, Buell Wesley Frazier, gave Oswald a ride to work on Assassination Day. Frazier later testified Oswald carried a package with him which could have contained a rifle. Frazier said Oswald claimed it was curtain rods, but this is the end and beginning of Frazier's involvement. Ruth Payne, on the other hand, was involved with both Lee and Marina Oswald before and after the assassination. Ruth was working with the East-West Contact Service arranging cultural exchanges between the U.S. and USSR. When introduced to the Oswalds in February 1963, in July, Ruth offered to have Oswald's wife, Marina, live with her and promised to give Marina $10 a week. In October, Ruth told Lee about the job at the Texas Book Depository. After Lee had been killed by Jack Ruby, Ruth provided critical evidence linking Lee with yet another assassination attempt. A would-be assassin fired out of the night through a window at Major General Edwin A. Walker on April 1963. Walker had been forced to resign from the Army due to his extremist right-wing activities, although no motive for the attempted murder of Walker has ever come to light. Ruth Payne provided a direct link between Oswald and the Walker incident. Ruth claimed to have found a note supposedly written by Oswald to his wife implicating himself in the Walker shooting. Ruth turned this note over to authorities after finding it, where Marina Oswald was supposed to have hidden it. It is not known why Marina kept such a note, if she did. After Lee told her to destroy it along with other incriminating evidence she had destroyed. The proof, allegedly in Lee's own handwriting, he had shot at Walker, was used to further demonstrate Oswald's capability to murder and his unbalanced mentality. If Oswald was being set up as a patsy, Ruth Payne was very influential in leading him there. But how did Ruth get the picture? But how did Ruth get into the picture? Sorry. Ruth and her estranged husband Michael were introduced to the Oswalds by Volkmar Schmidt. Schmidt had come from Germany in 1961 to do geological research in Texas. During this interview with author Epstein, Schmidt felt it was important to let Epstein know that in Heidelberg, Germany, Schmidt had lived with Dr. Wilhelm Kutemeyer, supposedly involved in the plot to assassinate Adolf Hitler near the end of World War II. Schmidt went on to paint Oswald as a totally alienated individual who verbally attacked Kennedy's foreign policies and compared General Edwin A. Walker to Hitler. Oswald, Schmidt claimed, had added both Kennedy and Walker should be considered murderers. Schmidt certainly substantiated Oswald's supposed disillusionment with America and Kennedy, links him to Walker by way of a motive, and introduced Ruth Payne into the unfolding scenario. But how had the German come to play his critical part? Volkmar Schmidt was introduced to Oswald by George Demorhenschitz. Yeah, get the book and read it. In early February 1963, Demorhenschitz had come into Oswald's life just after the defector returned to the United States in the summer of 1962. Demorhenschitz had arrived in America in May 1938 from Germany. During the war, he was connected to three suspected Nazi agents. Through a letter from the Nazi Baron Konstantin von Meidel, through contact with Saburo Matsukata, believed to be coordinating German and Japanese intelligence activities in the United States, through the address book of a suspected Nazi agent where Demorhenschitz's name was listed. Not only was Demorhenschitz... Nancy, next time, just use this guy's first name, because this is ridiculous. His first name is George. I'm going to call him George from now on. Not only was George associated with known or suspected Nazis, he had been investigated at one time or another by the FBI and CIA. According to CIA files, the Office of Naval Intelligence, ONI, had investigated George during the 1944 time frame. The ONI denies it ever investigated the man. George married into the Texas oil community in 1952 and worked in the oil business. Judging from some of his known acquaintances, George possessed influential contacts in both finance and the Navy, and had CIA Director George Bush's phone number in his address book. Bush later became the first Bush President of the United States. In May 1963, George left the United States for Haiti. Years later, after returning to the U.S., George agreed to a March 1977 meeting with Epstein to talk about the Kennedy murder. During the second day of interviews with Epstein, George went home for lunch and allegedly committed suicide. George's full role in the assassination apparently died with him. What was bothersome about George was the potential Nazi link. Could a Nazi oath have bound all the seemingly diverse people involved in the planning, execution, and cover-up of the assassination? This was initially just a passing thought, too bizarre to be considered, required too much imagination, except for one thing. My imagination had already been stretched beyond any fiction novel. I had reason to suspect modern-day Nazis had developed psionic weapons, commonly referred to as psychic weapons. Not only that, the U.S. Navy was involved in the initial experimentation that led to these weapons, and that experimentation was conducted in 1943. A year later was the time frame the Office of Naval Intelligence was supposed to have investigated George. Okay, that's the end of chapter 2, and I think we're going to stop now, because we're pretty close to the time anyway. So, I hope some of you are keeping up with this a little bit better than I am, because I just see an awful lot of strings all over the place, up and down and all around and getting tangled and yeah. So, we will start with chapter 3 next week, and see where it takes us from there. Thank you for joining me for surfing and trying to learn this stuff with me, or maybe just being reminded of all of this stuff that happened or supposedly happened in all of these different realities that we work with and live in. And thank you. Thank you for being here. And I hope you enjoyed it. And if you didn't, you don't have to listen. Thanks. Talk to you later. Bye.
You have been listening to Sassy Reads for You with Annette Bobko, a production of Cosmic Reality Radio. Radio player and archives can be found at cosmicreality.com.